Totally Football Show. Are you ready for another big weekend of footballs, VAR calls and Holloway handball downfalls? We are. And with a sizzling lineup of games ahead, including the goaliest fixture in the Premier League, Liverpool-Arsenal, we're set for a big one. We ask, what is your favourite clash of these titans? Will it be a titan this time around? Plus, we'll talk about the other interesting bits from the rest of the weekend's fixtures, get the latest on Europe, and so much more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. In your ears today, you have Mighty Michael Cox.
Hi, James.
Author of The Mixer, Big Duncan Alexander.
Hi, James.
Fresh out of Opta.
Yeah.
And Howling Lindsay Hooper.
Oh, Howling. I wonder where you were going there. Howling. Yeah, I'll take that one.
Good. Big day for Wolves today, wow. Lindsay, as you'll have noticed.
Very much so, yeah. Torino, Adama Traore is on the plane.
Yes.
After forgetting his passport last time.
Oh, did he have a missed passport?
No. There's one player you want to run fast to an airport, probably is Adama Traore.
So. Fair. Although...
he thought he could travel on just his ID card.
Well, anyway, a huge game coming up against Torino in the Europa League qualifiers. Part of a busy, busy schedule for Wolves. 5 games in 14 days, I believe I'm right in saying.
It is a busy fixture schedule, but... everyone who's spoken to me ahead of this season starting and warned me about, you know, the woes of playing in the Europa League or the foreign travel, the way that it's going to take it out of the players. And what you might find, Lindsay, is that you might find that Wolves aren't in the top 10 this season. I've been warned by many people. However, I would say that for Wolves, what they did is they achieved a lot very quickly in that first season back in the Premier League. And they were used to championship football, weren't they, the season before? Playing twice a week, playing all of those fixtures. I don't think they've really got out of that habit. And just being around the club and speaking to the players, they seem to be thriving from having this many fixtures, especially because they've got these new faces that have come into the club that want game time as well. So I spoke to Patrick Cotrone this week, and you know he's very excited about the Europa League because he probably sees that as his avenue to getting into the Premier League starting
well,
11.
How was his English, by the way?
This is a sore subject because we had to do it via Italian translation and it didn't go so well.
Ah, all right.
But you know, it was okay. It was fine.
Okay. Well, in a second, we'll catch up on Wolverhampton Wanderers' last fixture, Monday night, in the Premier League against Man United.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Monday night at Molineux, Wolves faced Man United. Martial scored.
Lingard, Rashford, Shaw coming in. And in the end, it's fired in by Martial. There's the 50. It just...
Ruben Neves equalised.
Ruben Neves to shoot. Oh, they had to wait for it.
And then Pogba took a penalty instead of Marcus Rashford. And Rui Patricio saved it and everyone's head exploded.
This is a Manchester United penalty. This is not a tombola.
What's Daniel James saying
to him
there?
This is not under fives on the playground.
It's not a tombola. It's a Man United penalty. So points shared. Pog in the doghouse once more. And while it's probably fair to mention, no one has a worse record on penalties than him in the entire Premier League. Am I right, Duncan?
No, that's not true.
Well, since the start of last season.
No one will beat Juan Pablo Angel's 50% conversion rate, which is not great.
He's missed four, though, hasn't he, since the start.
Yeah, and Angel probably wasn't taking the ball off his teammates with perfect records to take them.
True.
He did miss two in one game at Fulham.
Angel?
Yeah, okay. I wasn't there, James, don't worry.
Okay, all right. Nothing wrong with being at Fulham. But anyway, before we get into any of that, if indeed we're going to, what a save from Rui Patricio.
It was all right. I mean, statistically, it's the worst place to put a penalty. He hit it hard, I'll give him that. But if you dive the right way, I think you're saving that the majority of the time. Just like a third up, slightly across your body, it's the worst place to put a penalty.
It was interesting, obviously, that he didn't do his famous run-up. With which he often scored, but criticised. But this one was a standard run-up and a standard miss.
Well, on the subject of delayed run-ups, who might Wolves be in action against this week?
Oh, Zaza.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, interesting. Lindsay, what a goal from Ruben Neves as well.
Yeah, I mean, he just scores these wonder goals, doesn't he? I think 10 of his 13 have come from outside the box. He scored in the opening game. So I was at Molineux when they played Everton, and he scored that free kick for the first game at Molineux last season. He scored in the first game this season. But then they did die off. He isn't that player that if you're thinking about regular goal scorers, he tends to only get sort of four or five per season.
He tends to score really good goals at the start of the season, which basically gives him a free pass the rest of the season. He had like 70-odd shots from long range last season and scored.
He gets everyone talking about him at the start, and that maintains it for the rest of the campaign. But he is such a good player.
He scores at the start, and then it's never say nevers again.
Nice.
Anyway.
Extended his good stat where he's had three touches inside the penalty area in his Premier League career, and he now has a total of five goals, which is...
Very impressive.
Yeah.
On a broader level, from Wolves' point of view, a good point, especially given that you failed to register a single shot on target in the first half of the game, and it was only in the introduction of absent-mindedness's Adama Traore that Nuno was able to turn this thing around.
Well, that is the best that I've seen him play in a Wolves shirt, easily. And who would have known? He needed more space ahead of him. That's what he needed to come on for Matt Doherty and have more space to run at. I think that probably is a
position
he should play.
So did he play in a more withdrawn position then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I felt that in that role, he had that freedom that he wants and be able to inject that pace. Luke Shaw really couldn't handle him, and that was evident in that second half, and he had much joy. He was also much better with his feet, much better with the crossing. I think that's something he's been working on in training quite a lot, and it was a brilliant performance. I think without him, we weren't going to take anything from that game. So, I have to give some plaudits to Traore. But just from a Manchester United point of view, given the results at Molineux last season, both 2-1 defeats, if you look at the cup in the league, they went away. They looked dejected in the tunnel afterwards because I was there waiting to do some of the interviews. But actually, when I spoke to Marcus Rashford, they actually were really pleased with the progress. Mm. And he was talking about them moving in the right direction. If you compared it to last season, there were big improvements. And I have to say, when you talk about the on target, I mean, overall in the entire match, Wolves had four shots off target, two on target.
Wow.
I mean, this brings up a whole other debate with VAR as well in a second, but Man United 7 off target, 1 on target. And I think that says all that you need to know, which Man United maybe need to be a bit more clinical and certainly better on target with their shots.
Did you speak to Anthony Martial?
I didn't. No.
Okay, because he just had his second goal in two games. Phenomenal statistics.
And a brilliant finish. But it was a brilliant finish.
It was a good finish.
And it was a great move. And Wolves really couldn't cope with that. Wolves, by the way, 17 fouls compared to how many do you think United had? 6.
Is that all?
Yeah.
Oh.
So I think there was a bit of out-muscling going on as well.
Oh, good.
Trying to niggle.
If we talk about the furore to do with the penalty.
Okay.
Obviously, a lot of people were upset about what happened. But particularly Gary Neville, I think we all witnessed. Neville actually played in a United game against Burnley, early first game of the 2009-10 season. Mm-hmm. Burnley, the first time they came up. United got a penalty. Michael Carrick took it after the game and missed it. After the game, Alex Ferguson said he wasn't sure who the penalty taker was. He thought it was going to be Rooney or maybe Michael Owen.
Really?
So it's not like it's a brand new thing that's never happened before. It happens quite a lot.
Pogba was taking spot kicks, I think, last season, wasn't he? But as we've mentioned before, did so very badly that Rashford, whose record is much better, looked like he was set to take this one.
There was this discussion as well afterwards about, you know, if you've won the penalty, then you take the penalty if it's either of them.
But usually it's the other way around.
Often some managers say if you've won the penalty, then you don't take it because you're all het up. But there's also a kind of sliding doors thing with penalties as well, because if you remember, the game that essentially got Solskjaer the job was the PSG match, which Pogba was suspended for, which meant that Rashford took the penalty in the last minute that got them through. So, you know, do your own math.
Well, let's do a flip reverse it on that one. Love that. I mentioned Martial's stats. I know, Duncan, you were keen to talk about the bigger number issue with Martial, which is the one on his back.
Yeah, he's gone back to number 9, and as you said, is now deadly with 2-2. And it's quite rare. I think he's the only the third United player after Paul Scholes and Antonio Valencia to start with one number, move away, and then go back to the original number.
But it's quite common to change your number once.
Yeah, that happens a lot, because obviously players might come into a club, get a really random number, and then one becomes available that they prefer.
Did he have to give up the 9 for Lukaku?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and his goal scoring record is a lot better in nine, so maybe there is something to it. I mean, Michael's Fulham, there's a famous example where Steve Sidwell did the same. He had number seven. Pavel Pogrebniak came in, said, right. Hey, I want seven. Right. So Sidwell went, yeah, fine, went to four. Then Big Pav left and Sidwell went back to seven. I mean, I think of it often, actually.
I wonder right. who's done it the most.
I don't know, but it's often a feature of the contract that it is stipulated that a player will have a particular number.
Well, there was the issue when David Beckham joined Real Madrid, obviously synonymous with number seven.
Right.
But going to Real Madrid, that wasn't going to happen. So he spent ages choosing a number and then went for 23 because was it Michael Jordan's number?
Mm. Is that right? Okay. Zamorano famously at Inter Milan when he ran around with 1+8. Do you remember that? Because that makes nine.
Nine, yeah.
We had 1-8 and then he put a plus. I don't know if somebody sewed that on or used athletic tape or something.
I think my favourite squad number thing is a Hartlepool fan once told me that Chris Turner gave a lone striker the number three shirt to show that he valued him as a first teamer, which I think is a nice, if unnecessary, touch.
Right. Are you one of those people who gets upset about random team numbers, like strikers in number threes or goalkeepers in number 11s or similar?
Yeah.
Right.
I don't really like them over 50.
Really?
Remember
when Buffon had 88?
Yeah.
Well, the 2011 Russian Premier League season, which I'm sure we all think fondly of, the average squad number was 27.4. There were nine players with the number 99 shirt. I mean,
you're kidding.
Yeah.
By the way, the 88 of Buffon, then, you know, any Antifa out there will be, their ears will be pricking at that. And he always denied any knowledge of that significance to the particular combination.
Crazy coincidence.
Yeah. Right. Should Jesse Lingard change his shirt number? Because, Duncan, I saw you tweet an extraordinary The Pool-esque stat this week about his remarkable run, which basically is that in only one of the last 11 months has Lingard contributed either a goal or an assist for Man United.
Yeah, last December he had four goals and two assists. It was quite an up-and-down month for United, if you remember. Mourinho left, Solskjaer came in, he did well. But then, yeah, that's it. All the other months have been blank. Now, I felt a bit bad because then I was inundated with responses of people then, you know, blaming nonsensical things like, you know, his...
A pigeon?
No, the incident with the pigeon wasn't mentioned, actually. Actually, no, it was.
Advent calendar boost?
Yes. No, but more like, you know, the classics, oh, Lingard spends too much time on social media, blah, 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 which is clearly nonsensical in terms of his form. But it is quite a quirky little
It was spell. His exchange with Pogba, though, that won the penalty, wasn't it?
There you go.
I thought he played quite well, actually, Lingard. He's a funny player. Because I think he often plays quite well, but he just doesn't seem to get the goal contributions.
Right. He performs another role in the team.
I think his link plays good. He's intelligent with his movement. I think he's hard working. He presses well. But if you are playing that system, you kind of want more from your number 10, don't you?
Mm.
His movement is what causes other teams' problems. So sometimes what he does off the ball rather than what he does on it, because he draws players away. And that did happen quite a few times at Molineux on Monday.
Mm.
So, but you know, you do want him to be among the stats more with assists and goals.
Also with Lingard, there's the question of whether it's really him playing. As he himself asked last season, did you see that? Did you see that? When he did a thing with Marcus Rashford pre a Champions League round, I think, and where he and Rashford were discussing what it's like being youngsters who've broken into the Man United first team. Well, we'll dig that out maybe and see if we can hear that in a second or two. But next up for United, they're going to be at home to Palace, who've literally never beaten them in the Premier League, Duncan.
They haven't won away at Old Trafford in the league since the day after Alan Bradley got killed by a tram in Coronation Street. So
when was that?
1989. Very dark weekend for Greater Manchester.
Okay. Bizarrely, I remember that. My mum's a big Corrie fan. Okay. I remember that being on telly.
But this is the kind of game that Palace often excel in. I mean, away...
Well, it really isn't.
Not specifically this fixture, but away at big sides, you fancy them more than at home. At home, when they're up against a deep defence, they just can't score. They cross the ball, Benteke misses loads of chances. But away from home, with Zaha on the break, Zaha against Wan-Bissaka is going to be a fascinating clash.
Right.
I'm quite up for this game.
The other clash that looks interesting, Football 365 pointing out this season the most fouls have come from Luka Milivojevic, who's had a foul every 18 minutes, whereas the most fouled player is Daniel James, who's had eight so far, and they could be facing each other here.
I was going to say that the thing that I'm looking forward to is this this debate of who's going to get hacked down more, Daniel James or Wilf Zaha.
Right.
Because apparently both the most targeted, if you believe the most recent stats about Daniel James, they're the most targeted players in the Premier League.
Wolves, by the way, Turin tonight. And then on Sunday, another team in Granada, sort of, Burnley and the deadly Ashley Barnes.
Who likes to dine in Five Guys.
Does he?
Yeah, so
he was
in Five Guys, wasn't he, after the game, where the opening game where he got two goals. I think there were pictures all over social media of him dining in Five Guys.
Right.
Keeping it with the people.
By the way, listener, that Lingard and Martial exchange, a two-hander they were doing for UEFA.com, sounded like this.
Before the last game, we're reading like the match day programme, and he's looking at pictures of us all celebrating from last games. And then he nudges me, but I've got my headphones in. And then I'm like, what? And he goes, Rash, is that us? And he starts touching his own face, and then touching the paper, and he goes, we actually play for you.
Like, how do we know though? That is us, how do we know?
You actually don't know though.
No, but you do.
You don't.
You do.
You don't.
Right, just think for 5 seconds.
Your face might not be my crush's face, has it?
I don't know.
Who is it then?
Who is it then?
I don't know. It might
That's really
know.
Sweet, isn't it?
Yeah, it reminds me of a story where Dennis Bergkamp signed for Arsenal and he said it only really sunk in, even though he'd signed the contract, when he went back to his hotel room and turned on teletext and it said Bergkamp signs for Arsenal, which I really liked because I was surprised that he would go on teletext, but apparently... in parts of Holland, you could get British teletext because of the signal.
They kept it going a lot longer than the UK as well.
Is that right?
Yeah, the Low Countries are a huge fan of the teletext-based news system.
Right.
I bet you never used teletext, James.
I did, actually. Oh. I used to be... I remember in hotel rooms...
Okay.
Bamboozle fan.
In Italy, watching Italian teletext.
Oh, yeah.
And waiting for the page. You know, if there was, say, three pages, you'd be waiting for the third one to load up, which had the story you were waiting for.
And then you'd have to wait for
exactly,
it to go all the way around again.
Like a train in the morning.
Yeah, like a train in the morning.
Very much so. Anyway, up next, let's get on to that Liverpool-Arsenal clash, eh?
It's nice to have a break from advertising, so here's some classical music. Nice. Mm. At Paddy Power, we thought football shirts could use a break from advertising too. That's why we've sponsored Huddersfield Town's shirt without a logo and started the Save Our Shirt campaign, where any football team that Paddy Power sponsor will be, well, unsponsored. Don't you wish we weren't on your shirt too? Now, let's get Bark to the music. Paddy Power, enough of the nonsense. 18 plus, begambleaware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Liverpool Arsenal, Duncan, Michael, Lindsay. Liverpool Arsenal. This fixture, I put it to you, doesn't get the love it deserves. Arsenal's most kind of classicus games, you think of Chelsea or Man United and all that. And the same for Liverpool. You don't think of Arsenal as being their historic adversary. But yet, this is a game that's given us... and more goals than any other Premier League fixture, Duncan, am I right?
You are right. Not only that, more hat-tricks than any other Premier League fixture. More 90th minute winners than any other Premier League fixture.
The latest goal in Premier League history.
The latest goal.
Dirk Kuyt, remember that one?
101 minutes and 48 seconds.
What used to be the, or maybe still is the fastest hat-trick in Premier League history, Fowler's, no, in 94, in four
that
and a half minutes.
Was the fastest until Sadio Mane, who now plays in this fixture with aplomb. That... Kuyt goal, by the way, the game would reach the same point as the length of Casablanca by that point.
Right.
And let's hope the two giants can play it again this weekend.
Oh, that's very nicely done, Duncan. Michael, as the Premier League's de facto biographer, by means of your excellent book, The Mixer, which ones stand out for you?
I'm probably not allowed to say the FA Cup final, am I?
The 2001?
Yeah.
Well, you can say that if you want.
It was just a very memorable FA Cup final, obviously.
Tell us why.
Well, Arsenal dominated and led for a long period of time. And then going into the last 10 minutes, Michael Owen scored two goals. The second one, a really good goal on the run with his left foot. Probably led to Arsene Wenger overhauling that back four a little bit more quickly than he would have done, which I think was obviously very useful because Arsenal then won two of the next three titles. But he probably also won Michael Owen the Ballon d'Or that year. I know it seems funny to say about an FA Cup final, but it was a year where there wasn't an outstanding candidate for the Ballon d'Or. Owen won a lot of trophies that year, played well in a couple of the other finals. But it was really the FA Cup that he completely turned around.
Right.
He had obviously the England game a few months later against Germany, which I think kind of sealed the deal. But he says that game is his favourite, you know, that performance is his favourite ever performance, and those goals are his favourite goals. So it obviously lives long in his memory.
He was really criticised for not having a left foot until that point.
I see.
And then scored the winner with his left foot. So that was quite a big moment for him, I think.
This fixture is so storied. It goes even before the dawn of the Premier League.
Yeah.
The famous It's Up for Grabs Now, Mickey Thomas League Finale. One of the greatest ever league finales.
Possibly the greatest. I mean, people will say the Aguero QPR game, but the fact that the Michael Thomas game was between the two teams who could win the league, and Liverpool hadn't lost at home by two goals for such a long time, and you know, so many iconic moments. Steve McMahon, even a year later in 1990, Liverpool had won the title back from Arsenal.
Right. And was Mickey Thomas playing for them by this point?
Not by this point. He was signed by Sue Nesp. So we go to autumn 1990, and this was the season that Kenny Dalglish ended up resigning from Liverpool. But Liverpool were like untouchable at this time. They went to Highbury. They'd won 12 and drawn two of their opening 14 games, and everyone was like, well, once again, Liverpool going to romp the title. Strangely, Dalglish then played six defenders in that game, which is pretty unusual. They lost 3-0 and never really recovered. And a few months later, Dalglish was gone. Liverpool never won the title since. So that game at the time felt like, you know, a fairly run-of-the-mill game for Liverpool. It's pretty much changed history.
2009. You remember that when under Benitez, it looked like they might be set for an unlikely title bid once again, when they hosted Arsenal. No, rather, they hosted Andrei Arshavin, effectively, and drew 4-4 with the Russian. And wasn't that a performance out of nowhere?
Here comes Fabianski. Oh, and Walcott. A long way to go, but he's capable of doing that. Alonso. Here's Arshavin. He's played in. Arshavin. He's done it! Four! In the 90th minute!
Yeah, it was bizarre. I mean, Arshavin barely touched the ball in that game, aside from scoring four goals.
He had four shots and scored with all four. It's the only time a player in Premier League history has ever scored four goals and not ended on the winning team, which is quite Arsenal. But given they've also the only team that have ever been 4-0 up and not won a game as well against Newcastle.
He's such an extraordinary figure as well. My recollection is that he effectively had two good games in his career, but that can't be true.
When I think of Arshavin, I think he essentially signed for Arsenal about a week after the transfer window closed. There seemed to be a man outside the Emirates in a snowstorm for about a week saying, he's almost here, he's almost here.
He'd had an amazing 2008 European Championships with Russia, and a rather less stellar Arsenal career. Last seen riding a horse, do you remember? The end of last season, he was kicked out of a strip club, I think, in St. Petersburg. So he rode a horse down the streets of that town, presumably exploiting some forgotten bylaw or something.
That classic manoeuvre.
I remember seeing in my secondary school where a boy got expelled from school and the next day came riding past the school on a horse.
Really?
Shouting abuse at teachers, which is one of my favourite school memories.
Where did you get the horse from?
I wouldn't like to comment on that.
Okay. Andrei Arshavin, who retired only 2018. He'd been active in the Kazakh League, I say active, within the context of his career. But equally, you know, we talk about that time where Liverpool's title challenge came royally unstuck. 2014, probably the last time we took Arsenal seriously as title contenders, they went to, you're grimacing, they were league leaders. It was February.
No, but I mean, they were in the title challenge in 2016 as well, the Leicester season.
Well, yeah, okay, fair point. But top of the table, February 2014, they went to Anfield looking to solidify their hold on first place, but something quite different happened, courtesy of, and talk about unlikely, a Martin Skrtel brace inside the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary game. I mean, Suarez's performance is one of the best I've seen in Premier League history, I think, although he didn't actually score in that game.
No, he didn't, did he? So they were 4-0 down after 20 minutes. It finished up 5-1. The other goal scorers were
Sturridge, Sterling.
That's right.
Arsenal's was a penalty.
Yeah, that game sort of set the template for modern Liverpool-Arsenal games at Anfield, really. I mean, even last season we saw Arsenal had the temerity to score early on and then Liverpool like after being prodded like a tiger with a stick, just went down the other end of the pitch and said, we'll beat you heavily once more. I mean, Roberto Firmino is a particular thorn in their side at the moment.
A hat-trick. That was last December, wasn't it? In a 5-1 Liverpool victory. Lindsay, are they going to prod the tiger this time, do you think, Arsenal?
I think the most likely thing that they can do is have a high-scoring draw.
Right.
I don't see them winning at Anfield just because of that history and how many goals have been scored there. Also, how many times they concede. I mean, in the last 6 matches in that thread where, you know, they've had 5-1, they've lost twice. There's been a 4-0 demolition, 3-1, isn't it? All the past 6 Merseyside derbies. They've conceded at least 2 goals per game, so 22 in total. So I can't see Arsenal not conceding, but I also think that if Unai Emery is brave enough to go with this front three to match Liverpool's front three, then there should be goals. So maybe a high-scoring draw.
Well, that's one of the questions, isn't it? With Adrian in for Alisson and with Liverpool perhaps still with a muscle memory of passing back to a keeper who can deal with it, could the pace of the likes of Aubameyang putting pressure on the keeper, could that prove a key factor?
So I was just going to say about Aubameyang that actually don't get too excited about him.
Right.
Because against top 6 opposition, he doesn't actually have the best record of scoring. So he's scored 3 goals in 13 games against the top 6, but against the rest of the league, 31 in 38. So he isn't big at scoring against the big teams. But having said that, we haven't seen him with Pepe around him before.
I mean, Emery hasn't always started him in big games. I mean, he's often chosen between him and Lacazette. I think he will play him. And I think it would be interesting to see him up against Alexander-Arnold, because obviously you've got to be careful with Alexander-Arnold because he's so creative. But the first, well, the 2 games he's played this season, he's left so much space behind him for attackers to run into. So I'd quite like to see Emery be brave and maybe on the other flank go for someone a little bit more cautious. But he could be a big factor here, I think.
And it's that space behind him that is going to be the interesting part of the game, I think. I think really there's a battle in midfield. If Fabinho starts for Liverpool, which we think he will, it's most likely, isn't it, Henderson and Wijnaldum. I honestly think that could be the key battle in that part of the pitch. You know, if Torreira starts, it is going to be who can defend that back defensive lineup, however they line up, the best, because I do think that they can be breached. And like you say, with Alisson now injured as well, there is that possibility that Arsenal could actually breach Liverpool's defence more than they have before.
Top 2 in the league, Michael. Top of the table clash.
I don't count the league table until after 3 games, James. I'm a traditionalist.
Good point. This is the first time since 1990, which we've mentioned, that both Arsenal and Liverpool started with 2 wins out of 2. So we are heading back.
Klaxon alert. Klopp's never lost, has he, to Arsenal?
True.
With Liverpool.
Very true. Listener, what's your favourite fixture? Do write in and tell us. Send a stamped address envelope. And we'll feature that in our special listeners' post bag, probably. If there are some really good ones, what's your favourite fixture not involving Wolves, Lindsay?
I've really become a big fan of the Manchester derby in recent years, which I never thought would pull me in the way that it has. I think it's probably ever since that epic where Rooney scored the overhead kick, I've just always thought they've been good matches.
Michael?
The Classico.
Really? Crystal Palace Brighton?
Yeah, that one. Yeah.
Cool.
What I find interesting about fixtures is certain fixtures, you feel like you've seen a lot of them. And like North London derbies, I feel like I've, over the years, missed quite a few of them. Whereas I can remember, say, Merseyside derbies really clearly. So, I don't know. I'm not really sure of the point I'm making, but I think that...
Listeners, what is the point Duncan's making?
Yeah. I think you kind of have an affinity to certain fixtures. And
right. No, definitely.
Like a ley line.
Can I tell you what my least favourite fixture is?
Okay.
Liverpool-Man United.
Because generally...
Just rubbish games constantly. Right.
I once watched that game in a pub in Manchester and they didn't have a big screen, so they projected the game onto a bed sheet. And every time anyone went to the toilet and the door opened, the sheet kind of billowed and it was hard to follow the flow of the game.
You probably didn't miss much.
Loads more to come from the Premier League this weekend, and we'll look at some of those fixtures. Perhaps you'd like to pick out a fixture that most excites you each.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get onto that, just to mention some of the huge games going on around Europe. Schalke Bayern, for example, in the Bundesliga. Will Coutinho make his debut for his new German side, Bayern Munich? That's Saturday tea time kickoff there. Barcelona in Spain, who are behind Real Madrid for the first time in 76 game weeks, as Alvaro Romeo was revealing on Tuesday's Totally, will be hosting Betis. Betis beat them there last season. Barcelona will have no Messi and no Suarez. Could another upset be on the cards. In Italy, Serie A gets underway. Parma Juve's the opening game on Saturday. Fiorentina Napoli follow straight afterwards with Frank Ribery, Fiorentina's new signing, on the bench at least, says their manager Vincenzo Montella. Will Inter have Alexis Sanchez when they face off against newly promoted Lecce on Sunday? I don't know. In Portugal, it's only Benfica Porto on Saturday. Could be the standout fixture.
I nearly said that as my favourite fixture.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Why do you like Benfica Porto so much?
Because they're always big games. They're always pretty much the top two for the league, and they're always just open and entertaining. You don't tend to get cagey nil-nils.
Right. You'll be tuning in on Saturday.
I'm not sure I've got the right channel.
No idea where.
You don't know where it is.
No idea.
Where do I watch?
There'll be a window on someone's laptop, I'm sure, that will be carrying it. And in France, where Paris Saint-Germain are currently eighth, Lindsay, eighth. They are going to be up against Toulouse, and you've got Lyon, Nice and Rennes, who are up top, level on points, all facing interesting games. Nice, actually, are up against Olympique Marseille, who are still looking for their first win. Do you know who Olympique Marseille's manager is these days? André Villas-Boas, that's right. So they haven't had a win yet, but if you're counting on anyone to help them rally...
Nice.
Villas-Boas, eh?
Yeah. Nice.
It's a lot to keep track of, all that European stuff, but luckily there is a special podcast every Tuesday on the Totally Football Show feed, which would do the job for you. Breaking news, by the way, Michael, that Benfica-Porto game, I can exclusively reveal, is on Free Sports, which is the standard definition, unless they've HD'd it over the summer, a branch of Premier Sports.
Yeah, that's good. They had the rights last season, but I didn't know they'd retained it. So
yeah, no,
good.
They have, and they'll be showing all the Italian stuff as well this weekend too.
Nice.
So that's nice. Excellent. All right, up next, back to the cozy comforts of the Premier League.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Right, Premier League this weekend, we've already talked about Arsenal, Liverpool, Wolves, Burnley and Man United taking on Crystal Palace. The other games, well, it kicks off Friday with Aston Villa, Everton. Then you've got Norwich against Chelsea Saturday lunchtime. Brighton, Saints in an all-South Coast affair. Watford, West Ham, two teams in search of a W. Sheffield United against Leicester. Sunday, Man City are at Bournemouth. Newcastle visits Spurs. Pick a game out of that lot. Lindsay.
I'm going to go with the game that I'm going to be at.
Ooh, which one's that?
Which is Watford, West Ham.
Ah.
Because if you actually implied there, you know, they're both in search of a win. But also, both have perhaps been deemed to be the two teams that could be vying for that seventh position, best of the rest, not had the best start to the season. Where are they? I think this is going to be a good account to find out that answer. Both looking to prove something. I think West Ham have got a little bit more leeway here because they had Manchester City on the opening day. Now, I know it was a 5-0 drubbing, but I think you put that result aside, they got the point against Brighton. Interesting, it's going to be Mark Noble. It's going to be the 15th anniversary of him making his debut at West Ham.
Is that right?
So he should be back. He's trained fully this week, so he should be back.
Not only 15 years, but also his 350th Premier League game if he plays. So
there you go.
Wow. Speaking of anniversaries, Sunday, it's going to be 25 years, almost to the day, since Jurgen Klinsmann made his debut for Spurs in that 4-3 win at Hillsborough.
Demonstrating how easy it is to sway the British public.
Right.
Like, oh, hate Klinsmann, he's evil. And then he dives off, he scores that goal. And everyone's like, brilliant.
Always
loved Klinsmann. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. That glorious innocent time. Anyway, Spurs, they're going to be hosting Newcastle. Son's back from suspension.
That's a boost. Yeah, I fancy Spurs for that. Newcastle have been quite unimpressive so far.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's a long way from Newcastle, London, so I imagine they might fly down, which will be good, because it reminds me of that bit in Steve Bruce's disappointing third book, Defender, when his character, Steve Barnes, says, he's flying over London. He says, I was able to clearly see several landmarks. I could see the dome at Greenwich and the whole outline of the Isle of Dogs, brackets, which isn't a complete island at all, close brackets, and is the setting for the soap opera EastEnders. So maybe he'll remember that.
Maybe Sunday morning as Steve and Newcastle circle above the City of London Airport.
Yeah.
Similar thoughts being racing.
I will be looking
mind.
In the sky to see if he's there.
Wow. That's brilliant. I was just going to mention that St. Maxim and Joe Ellington are both injured for Newcastle. So, yeah. Okay. Michael, what game most attracts your interest this weekend?
I think Norwich-Chelsea, which is sometimes a tricky away flight for London-based teams, controversially. I've been impressed by Norwich so far. I was impressed by them even when they lost on the opening day to Liverpool. And I think Chelsea's problem has been they haven't protected the defence well enough. Seems to be a lot of space between the lines. And the runs of Steeperman and Cantwell, I thought, were really effective last time out. Cantwell, I must say, I barely knew of before the Premier League, but he was excellent last weekend. Wonderful knack of receiving the ball in the half turn. And I wouldn't rule out Norwich winning this. And if so, you start to wonder about Chelsea and Lampard. They don't tend to give managers too long. I think Lampard has more leeway than anyone that's come before him. But, you know, Chelsea finished third last year. They won the Europa League. They can't go long without winning a game before people start to ask questions.
He'd be the first Chelsea manager not to win any of his first four games in charge, obviously with the Super Cup, since Bobby Campbell in 1988. So, I mean, obviously Chelsea have been very good in the interim. But yeah, as Michael... I mean, Michael, you did say in the pre-season that you thought they'd crash out of the top six. So.
I did, but then after the first two... Well, the loss to United and Liverpool, I actually thought they played all right. But they're a results-based club, aren't they? They're not a club that's used to, this is a long-term project, give it time. There's just not that history there.
Can Norwich pull off a massive surprise against Chelsea?
Well, Pirky's probably the key man here. I mean, he became only the second player to ever score a hat-trick in his second appearance in the Premier League after the legendary Clive Mendonca back in 98. He could become the new Pavel Pobrebniak, who did it in his third game. And if he gets another hat-trick, you know, people will take notice.
I don't think he'll get a hat-trick. Do you think he'll get a hat-trick against
Chelsea?
Two
words, Kurt Zouma.
Oh, he's been all right last couple of games.
Wow.
I felt really sorry for him at Old Trafford.
Yeah, me and all. But it's exciting. You mentioned Pavel Pogrebniak, who's a player I completely forgotten about. Where's he now?
I don't know.
Right. He must have retired.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah, he was quite old when he came, wasn't he?
Was he?
He played like he was old.
It's been that sort of season where players have just suddenly, some of them have just disappeared. I mean, Ashley Williams being released by Everton, got no club. But there's lots of older names that, you know, they haven't had a fanfare farewell.
Yeah, and John Terry got two. Seems unfair somehow.
Pavel Viktorovich Pogrebniak is a professional footballer who plays as a striker for FC Ural Yekaterinburg. And he wears number 88, apparently.
Oh. Well, he did play for Reading, which is the club with a very checkered history with squad numbers, giving one to the fans.
That's still going on,
by the way.
Oh, they still...
Yeah, it was on the back of the programme the other day.
Not for me, Pavel.
Duncan, is there a game that you are looking forward to above all others?
Sheffield United-Leicester, because... Uh-huh. This interested me. It might interest some other people. I find it particularly niche. This is the first ever top flight game between two teams who've won the top flight but never in the 20th century. Okay, so Sheffield United have only won the league once, did it in the 19th century.
Okay.
Leicester, obviously people remember, hopefully, that they won it a few years ago.
Yes.
So both league title winners, but never did it in the 20th century. I like that.
That's
niche.
No, but there's
a little bit of history to it.
Not every day you can say that about a fixture.
Football didn't start in the 20th century.
Indeed not.
Brackets, it started in the 19th. Well, actually, it didn't, did it?
I had a far more kind of parochial question. What's up with Jamie Vardy? Because you'd been talking the other day. We had that little discussion about what constitutes a shot on target and similar. But how many shots has he actually had? Well, he hasn't scored yet.
In his last 6 hours of Premier League football,
he's
had three shots.
Why is that, do you think? Is that...
I don't know. I thought he was quite lively against Chelsea. Had that one that he hit across the face of the goal.
Right.
Didn't think there was much wrong with
him. His movement's pretty good.
Yeah, he cut a very frustrated figure in some of the highlights that you've seen in the first two games.
Yeah.
Because I've only watched Leicester in sort of match of the day highlights. But he looked like he was getting very, very down about the fact that he was getting in these brilliant spots and no one was picking him out. But, you know, Jamie Vardy of old would have made sure that he kept going and got in those positions, whereas I think he looked to get a bit despondent.
Mm.
But Leicester, I think, have looked... They should have really won at Chelsea last week, the second half. They cut them open again and again. I mean, you talked about Wolves' fouls on Monday night. Sheffield United have actually made the most so far this season, which is interesting.
Their way into the Premier
League. Well, obviously, a few people got criticism for getting the wrong impression of Sheffield United before the season started, but maybe they were right all along.
maybe so. Aston Villa Everton on Friday is an opportunity for Jack Grealish to get his 21st defeat in a row. He's currently on that incredible run with the club. Toffees, meanwhile, the only side who have yet conceded a goal in the Premier League.
Yeah, they last started the season with three clean sheets in a row back in 1912. but only came 11th, so they were quite Everton-y even then. Just on Jack Grealish, actually, he's got the third highest expected assists so far this season. So he might lose every game forever, but he's still playing quite well.
Okay. All right, Brighton Saints, that is Graham Potter against his former club.
Got one on this if you want.
Okay, go on then, yeah.
Southampton are unbeaten in their last five games south of Southampton. They can only play, right, Bournemouth, Portsmouth or Brighton, which is south of Southampton.
Right.
I mean, yeah, they're quite good. Southampton.
Perhaps due to the geographical limitations of the British Isles, they haven't won a league game since April. Was that against a team south of them? Possibly, I'm not sure. Did you want to say something about Brighton and
no,
Saints?
Just wanted to say this is a genuine question.
Right.
Does anyone remember Graham Potter at Southampton? Like I've read so many times that he was at Southampton, but I don't recall.
He only played eight games in the Premier League.
Oh, is that right?
But I'd like to think if a player plays eight games in the Premier League, I'll remember him forever.
It must rankle that Ali Dyer played 20-odd minutes and gets remembered much, much more than Graham Potter.
Do you believe in the new look Brighton? Or is this just an early season
I think they've looked really good so far, but I think the interesting thing about them is, for all the kind of new vibes, I think Glenn Murray's been really good. You know, last time out, I thought he was excellent with his back to goal. And sometimes you do need that kind of player, almost playing the Giroud role. If you've got lots of technical players on rushing, you know, if you play someone with back to goal, laying the ball off, that can be really useful. So, you know, I thought he might get phased out, but it doesn't look like it so far.
And Lewis Dunk. He's a player that I thought someone would take away from Brighton this summer. They managed to hang on to him. But you talk about this new look Brighton, but we've both just mentioned, you know, hardy souls that have been there for some time.
Very, very true. The fixture that we haven't mentioned much is Man City, who visit Bournemouth, who've never beaten Man City in 14 previous league meetings, losing each of their last eight games. Although they have done a little bit better recently against Big Six opposition. They beat Chelsea in January at the Vitality and Spurs actually in May 1-0.
This game, this exact fixture last season, obviously semi-famous for the fact that Bournemouth didn't have a single shot. Their stats in that game were no shots, five touches in the opposition box, 87 passes in the opposition half, and 18% possession.
Wow. Top word, Duncan. By the way, you're probably aware that you're joining us for Totally Football Live in London in a few weeks' time. You got that date, I hope, marked in your diary, the 30th of September. It's a Monday. Listener, if you'd like to join us there, that's me, Duncan, James Horncastle and Julien Laurence. We're going to be at the South Bank Centre. Then get along to southbankcentre.co.uk and have a search for Totally Football Show. I think there's actually a picture and you can click on that. It'll be a lot of fun and games and stats and fun and games and all that sort of thing. Good, that's the Premier League weekend. Very shortly, we'll have a look and see if there's been any nice tweets for us. And, Nick Miller's joining us as well with news on the unfortunate Bury and Bolton and things like that. And we'll cover some other business as well. But right now, here's producer Ben.
Thank you very much, Jimbo. Lee Price from Paddy Power is on the line. Lee, we've been speaking extensively about Liverpool and Arsenal in the show this week. So please give us the numbers on there being four or more goals at Anfield this Saturday.
Yeah, we think there will be goals in this one. Brave call, I know. It's just 11-10, so just over evens, that there'll be 3.5 goals in this game. No, VAR isn't going to start ruling out half goals. That just means basically four or more goals, as you've requested there. Or you can get 13-5, there are 4.5 goals, i.e. five or more. Or you think there's going to be quite a tight game, it's 11-2 that one goal wins it. And we have got money back as a free bet if Mohamed Salah scores. Selected markets only, pretty much singles only, max free bet £10, T&Cs apply.
Timu Pukki is the top scorer in the Premier League at the moment, so is he going to get another one against Chelsea?
I really hope so. There's something quite cute and endearing about Pukki, although I'm sure he won't thank me for saying that. It's 17-10 he scores any time against Chelsea, and their defence has left a lot of space so far this season, so I can definitely see that. If you really think he's going to make a mark, it's 11-2 he scores first, or the same price, 11-2, that he scores last.
Things haven't been going so well for Villa at the moment. Can they get their first points on the board?
Not sure I can see this one coming. Everton in good form, Villa not. It's 2-1 the Villains win at home here. 5-2 they get a draw, or 5-4 the away side win Everton. That's quite a good price. If you do think Villa will avoid defeat for the first time this season, it's 4-7 on a double chance. That means they either win or draw, and you win.
You can find these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Hello, Nick Miller.
Hello, James.
Hi, Nick Miller.
I heard you talking about Jürgen Klinsmann earlier on. There's actually an interesting article on the toddleyfootballshow.com about why Jürgen Klinsmann signed for Tottenham all those years ago.
Oh, really? Would you like to throw us a little teasing tidbit?
Well, it seems he decided to sign for Tottenham because he had a very nice cappuccino on Alan Sugar's yacht. That seemed to be the answer to it.
Really?
He just kind of fancied playing somewhere new, so he came to Tottenham.
But he must have been already thinking of Tottenham. Or was he on Alan Sugar's yacht for entirely coincidental reasons to do with perhaps Amstrad? Maybe that telephone. Do you remember that telephone?
The email phone?
That's the one.
Useful.
Yeah, but it's crazy the way that these kind of epochal moves come down to the smallest of incidents.
Yeah, well, the story that they both kind of tell is that they both, Sugar happened to be on his yacht in Monaco, and Klinsmann's agent called him and said, do you fancy signing Jürgen Klinsmann?
Right.
And Alan Sugar said, yes, please, I do.
He likes his coffee with sugar.
Oh, there you go.
I was going to say, do you want some sugar in your cappuccino? Yeah.
Right.
Very horribly wrong.
Brilliant. This is all
if only,
great.
If only I'd spoken to you before I wrote this article.
Right.
Anyway, that's available on the totallyfootballshow.com.
Excellent. Anything else on there we should be looking out for, Nick?
Well, there is an article about Bury, which throws nicely to what we're going to talk about. It's basically about what happens to clubs when they disappear, when they go out of business.
Which hopefully doesn't prove relevant, although time is really running out. It's tomorrow, isn't it, that they have to demonstrate their financial viability, or at least Steve Dale has to reveal that he's got the means to keep them going.
Well, Steve Dale or someone else. There were some reports this morning that Steve Dale wants around £2 million as fees for his time since sort of buying the club for £1 earlier on this year. So who knows whether it's actually going to go through.
135 years of history and potentially a really big blow for the local community. A lot of Bury fans speaking out. A former director, Joy Hart, chaining herself to a drainpipe in a bid to save the beleaguered team from impending extinction, I read. She said she'd originally planned to shackle herself to the Les Hart stand. That was her father, who was a Bury FC player. But she says, I'm afraid someone at the club has locked the gate, so that's kiboshed that. But a drainpipe anyway. And it certainly got the story a little bit more headline inches, and one can only hope that somehow before Friday's deadline something happens.
It's not looking good. I suppose the one thing that gives a little bit of hope is that an interested party only has to demonstrate they have the money. They don't have to actually fully kind of take over the club. Although this season, if they stick around, if this season's going to be tricky, they've already had I think six fixtures postponed or cancelled. But if Steve Dale does kind of eventually see sense and one of these people demonstrates that they have the money, then at least they'll be able to survive.
All right, well, fingers crossed. Bolton, meantime, another team that were featured in that article last week on the totallyfootballshow.com with some more bad news there. Phil Parkinson resigning.
Yeah, I mean, it's a miracle that he stayed there for this long because he's had to kind of manage players that have from their academy to playing in the first team who have done creditably, but they postponed a League Cup game this week basically on the basis of citing some kind of FA safeguarding regulations that prevents players that young from playing twice in a week,
right,
which the league wasn't happy with, but you can see why they did that. We talked about this quite a lot on the Totally Football League show this week,
so
go and have a listen to that. There's a sort of more extensive discussion of it there. But Bolton's game against Ipswich at the weekend is going ahead. It's just unclear as to who's actually going to manage them at the moment.
Quite a big detail that. Lindsay, you got the offside rule coming up.
Yes, and we had a bit of a Hollywood theme last week.
Nice.
Because we spoke about different celebrities we'd seen at football matches. That seemed to go down very well. So we're extending that a little bit further with footballers.
Can I just ask, I haven't actually heard that episode just yet. So who's the biggest celebrity you've seen at a football match?
Well, no, I just told a story about how I once interviewed Dave Gorman, having thought I was going to be interviewing Kim Cattrall at Liverpool. And it just got gradually downgraded as my day went on. And
Dave Gorman, the comedian?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, so there was a little bit of a story in there about that. And we're going to continue with that theme because there's a nice arts theme at Brighton, whereby, I don't know whether you're aware, that the assistant manager, Billy Reid, has starred in a feature film. And so we're going to talk about footballers and people in football that have been in films. And
right. Stan Collymore, obvs.
Yes.
Eric Cantona.
Obvs.
David Beckham. Yeah.
John Walk.
John Walk.
Yeah, we don't want the obvs, though,
that
do we?
That is obvs, yeah.
There's A Shot at Glory starring Ally McCoist and Robert Duvall.
That's amazing. Robert Duvall. I've seen it. Robert Duvall with a Scottish accent.
Yeah, it's quite a thing.
Might steal that one, Nick. Thanks.
No, it's worth having a look at that film. Really heartwarming story. Mm. Ally McCoist is actually, I have to say, really good in it. Because you'd think, you know, Robert Duvall, two titans of cinema coming together, Ally McCoist. But Ally McCoist more than holds his own. Mm. By the way, speaking of obvious footballers in films, Escape to Victory, I'm heartened to see that Reading currently have a Pelé and a Puskás in their lineup. I don't know whether Sylvester Stallone will be donning the gloves once more for the Royals, but that would be amazing. Solid gold content for you, Lindsay.
Yeah, yeah. I want to steal it all. We will also be talking about the European transfer window as well, which is still
good.
Open.
Isn't it, though? Another 2 weeks of that. It's madness, isn't it? These Europeans with their rules. Brilliant. Michael, here's a question from Maintain SJP. Sorry, Maintain, I should have put this in the Newcastle section, but can Michael decipher Steve Bruce's tactical game plan? He is our only hope, given it is just a total mess on the pitch. This isn't piling on Bruce, says Maintain. This is just further proof that Ashley is the worst owner in the league.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't gone well so far. They played, you know, five of the backers Benitez did.
Are tactics the issue?
No, not primarily. I'd say the primary issue is the fact that the really good thing they had going last year, particularly in the second half of the season, was the Rondon and Perez partnership. They right. worked really well together. They've both gone. Now they're playing Almiron off Joe Linton, and they don't have that relationship so far.
Right. Sell your two top scorers, you're going to hit some troubles. Duncan, you've had a question in.
Yes, Stephen Batchelor asked, given the Man United penalty farrago, good use of the word farrago there, which team have used the greatest number of different penalty takers in a season? And I did prepare this. And
Is it Arsenal?
It's not Arsenal. Someone replied to him and thought it was Manchester United under Van Gaal. It's actually another great thinker, Harry Redknapp, Portsmouth, in 2007-08. They had six different penalty takers.
Can we get?
Go for it, yeah.
Canu.
Yeah. Took one, missed it.
Crouchy.
Nope.
Solly Montari.
Took one, scored one.
Crenshaw.
Oh, I was going to say Crenshaw.
Took one, missed one.
Okay.
The others, should we?
Todorov.
John Tucker.
Good chat with Todorov.
That was producer Ben.
Really impressed. No. So who?
Defoe.
Defoe, yeah. Took two, scored two. He was, you know, he was the go-to man.
Brilliant.
Then Matt Taylor and Benjani as well.
Benjani.
Benjani, I wouldn't have.
So six, remembered. That's quite a lot, isn't it?
Excellent.
But they came eighth, so it all worked out fine.
It all worked out fine in the end. Very good. Well, that's it for today's Totally Football Show. Monday, it's a bank holiday, but I've just checked my contract and we'll still be here. Daniel Story will be joining us. Yeah, Tom Williams is also in, and Carl Anker to talk Saints. But many thanks for now to Nick, Duncan, Lindsay and Michael. And you, listener, have yourself a great bank holiday weekend. And we'll speak to you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter. And make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.